So this morning we again have a lot to talk about. So we'll go through this material in a hope a way that we'll have get the meat out of it that we need to get, and as well, but not I won't get bogged down on any one thing. Don't let me hinder any of you from making comments or observations about things that that you have noticed in your study. So we're working through a timeline of the life of Christ, and we have reached the Galilean ministry. We've been studying this for, I guess this is the second week of the Galilean ministry. And, what my habit has been is to put all the things that are in that period of time up on this slide, and they don't fit. I mean, there's just so many things that I just said, well, I can't get it all up there. So these are the things that we're going to deal with. We're going to start with the calling of Matthew, and work our way down through these things and end up with talking about 12 apostles being selected. So last week, we ended on the story of a lame man being lowered through the roof. Does anybody remember where that happened? That's right. And so, way up there, you'll remember that we've studied that Christ came down to Jerusalem, and he did some of his ministry there, but now he has gone back to the Galilee area, and he is working in this Galilee area. So, Mark 2, verse 13, where we kind of start today, it says, Then he went out again by the sea. Well, what sea would that be? I mean, it's logical, right? It'd be the Sea of Galilee, because he's in that region. And all the multitude came to him, and he taught them. This is the Sea of Galilee. Every time I put up pictures from Andrew, Jeremy's sitting right there. So Jeremy went, like, what, 2 weeks or 4 weeks right before Andrew went. And what I wanted you to observe in this is this picture was taken from the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. So you're looking to the west, and what do you see? You see mountains. And later in our study today, we'll talk about those mountains. That's where Jesus would retreat to, was these mountains. Now, another just observation, because I'm here, is a storm came in while they were there, and it just obscured the view of the other side. And we think about the stories where the apostles were in a boat, and a storm came up, and they became scared, and so that makes sense that it would be, the visibility would be just so lacking. And interesting, Andrew pointed out that there are still fishermen on the Sea of Galilee. They have nets in that boat. Alan, you and I were talking about the nets in the boat, and I was thinking about this picture when we were talking. It's still a very large fishing community. Did you see a lot of that when you were in that region, Jeremy? For the sake of our time, I'm not going to try to get us to answer every question. As a matter of fact, the first question in our material says, Matthew was also known as Levi. Is it missing the T and the F for you to circle or something? Maybe it's just a misprint. I looked at it and went, okay, true. But let's answer number three. Brother Jim, can we start with you, number three? So, Matthew, also called Levi, he was a publican. Why is he called a publican? He is a tax collector, but why is he called a publican? Because he's a public servant. That's what we would say, he's a public servant. They use the term publican. So he did. He worked for the government, and his job was he was a tax collector. I know tax collectors. Matter of fact, I've been audited 3 times when I was running my own business. They weren't so bad. They happen to be honest. What was the reputation? Yeah, because your tax bill might be 50, and they'd ask for 60 or 75, right? they'd turn in the 50 that they needed to turn in, but they'd pocket the rest. Was Matthew corrupt? I'm going to tell you, I don't think we know. There's absolutely nothing said to indicate that Matthew conducted his business in a corrupt fashion. There's just nothing that said that. Yes, by reputation they were. And by reputation, we often avoid contact with people who would just be of reputation, right? And so there is no doubt the reasoning behind the Pharisees' thoughts of why he'd be avoided. So Mark 2:14 says, as he passed by, he saw Levi the son of Alphaeus sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." So he arose and followed him. Didn't take much, did it? Why do you think it was just, that's all he did was just request that he follow him, and he just left his job? Why would that happen? What do we already know based on our study? Had there been quite the stir created in the Galilean area over the activities of Christ? You know, what are some of the things we already know that's happened in Galilee, in the area of Galilee? Yeah. Turn water to wine. He's known. And I don't think this was just that coincidental that Christ would call to Levi and for him to abandon everything. I think there's more to the story that we're just not made clear on. Had Jesus attracted a following in Galilee? Absolutely, we talked about that. And so the Pharisees, they object. And they say, you know, you're eating with sinners. You're eating with tax collectors. When we compare the stories, Matthew provided a feast. He provided quite the entertainment, quite the hospitality. What did the Pharisees provide? Yeah, criticism. They offered him nothing. They weren't even willing to listen to his teaching to most of the degree. And so they just criticized. Whereas Matthew honored Christ and was very interested to hear and have him in his home, I assume his home, wherever this feast took place, to learn more about the teachings that Christ offered. And so Christ gives this answer to the Pharisees. And he says, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick." So is he talking about their health and their wealth? What's he talking about? Their spiritual wealth and health, right? So unpack that for me. So Lisa had her wrist operated on first this year, and we met our deductible. And because we met our deductible, Lisa says, "Okay, old man, your turn." And all the things I've been complaining about, I've had just a slew of doctor's appointments recently. Why have I been going to the doctor? My shoulder hurts. My back hurts. I had a tooth that needed a crown. Would I have gone and seen the doctors had any of those things not been a complaint? Right, I wouldn't have wasted my time and my money and so forth. So, Christ is just making a very simple analogy that those that were the sinners, they were the ones who needed Him. Well, did that imply that the Pharisees were not sinners? So, what's He telling the Pharisees?
Here, how do you know you're not as unhealthy as they are?
Yeah, the Pharisees have rejected him. They're criticizing him. And he's saying, well, you don't want the healing that is being offered, and these people do. And so he goes to the people who are willing to hear the teaching that he has to offer. Oh, yeah. Anything else about this particular section? So now we have a controversy regarding fasting. And we got two questions in that section. Jeremy, do you have that?
Yes, I do raise the question regarding the disciples' failure to fast.
Okay, number two.
Let's see, what illustrations did Jesus use to answer the question? Well, there were, I think there were three of them. One was the bridegroom and his friends. The other one was the new and old garment. And the third was wine and wineskin.
So, they're at this feast of Matthew. And now the John's disciples are raising a question. You know, why are they not being observing of some fasting? What would fasting, when would fasting be appropriate? You know, I've had times in my life when eating was just not priority. They're just either through grief or stress, eating was just not something that came first. You can take one look at me and tell me that hadn't happened very often. But there has been times. And so in our mourning, in our grief, eating just becomes something that's not a priority. So they are criticizing these people for not being in some state of mourning. Brother Jim. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to come back to that thought. All right? And so they're criticizing these folks for not being in some state of distress, some state of mourning. And so he basically tells in his answer, well, that would be inappropriate. For them to be in a state of distress or mourning is just simply inappropriate. And he gives illustrations of inappropriate actions. To mend a garment with unshrunk fabric. Who's our seamstresses in here and can explain that to me? See, nobody sews anymore, right? How many of us grew up with mom having a sewing machine set up somewhere in the house, right? So, an unshrunk piece of fabric sewn into an older garment that has been washed. When we wash the garment as a whole, the unshrunk fabric would pull and it would destroy the mending that was done. It would be inappropriate to do that. It would be foolish, wouldn't it, to do that type of thing. To put old wineskins in with new wine. Now, I'm not even going to ask the question, who in here is an expert on that? But when you put grape juice into a container, that's the new wine, right? And then if it aged, what would happen to it? You know, it would expand. It would be a fermentation process and gases would be put off. So why would a old wineskin be inappropriate? Yeah, it's weak. Right, it burst. So these are inappropriate actions. So it's an inappropriate action to go into a mourning state of fasting before the death of Christ. They have him here. He is with us. We want to hear from him. We want to know what he has to teach us. So it would be inappropriate of them. So Brother Jim talked about it's often associated with prayer and fasting go together. So when would prayer and fasting make sense and it would be appropriate? What would we be grieving? And why would we be in prayer? That wasn't the only time. I'm just focusing on that one time. You'd be in distress maybe over your sins. You'd be in mourning over your transgressions against God. And in that time of prayer and speaking to God about your transgressions, if you were grieved over that, well then fasting would be appropriate in that time because of mourning and grieving over sin. There's actually, I want to say it's Hosea 6, it speaks of afflicting the body. I'm not remembering my notes right. There is a time that fasting is spoken of, and it has to do with the Day of Atonement. And it's really the only time that fasting is spoken of from a requirement standpoint. There's no other time that we find that fasting is commanded. It's something that has to be done in service to God. It's something that's more, it's been done more organically, more naturally, but then the Jews started making more out of it, and they started buying it. Dave? Very good. Anything else about this? Okay. Pool of Bethesda. Let's answer the three questions, first three questions in that section about the Pool of Bethesda.
How long had the lame man been infirm? 38 years.
What did Jesus tell the man to do, and how long did it take him to do it?
Okay.
What day was it? It was the Sabbath day. And why were the Jews upset? Because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day.
All right. So the timing of this particular event is very difficult to pin down. So we're studying it now because we're coupling it with, just like the writer has in John, he has coupled it with a couple of events that have to do with accusations about the Sabbath. And so we'll talk about two events, the second one being them eating grain as they pass through a field, right? So timing of this event, a little difficult to pin down. John 5, verse 2 says that the Pool of Bethesda was a pool having five porches. Growing up, I always thought it was a pentagon. You know, if it's got five porches, it's got to be a pentagon. And it's been fascinating to kind of look into this and see a little bit more about it. The Pool of Bethesda has been considered a legend until really in our lifetime. A lot of naysayers of biblical teaching would say, well, see there, that pool doesn't even exist. But what's interesting is that in 1888, Conrad Schick, a German archaeologist, that's two different words, he's both, and he was also a religious man. I have no idea what religious affiliation he was with, but he was a religious man. He discovered the first. There's two pools. They're side by side. He discovered the first one. But they still couldn't figure out that it was the Pool of Bethesda because he only found half of it. And he found the deep end of the pool, is basically what you might say. It was in 1964 that further excavations of that area led to the discovery of the other half of the pool. And I say half, don't take me literally on that. The other end of the pool. And it was the shallow end. It was the end where any kind of ritualistic bathing, any type activities like that would have been done. The two pools of water were separated by a dam, and they had a system by which they could purify the water to release it into the shallow end of the pool. So the word porches is probably an unfortunate translation. I think it would have been better if they had called it a colonnade. Colonnade looks like this. It's basically a roof supported by columns. You can have multiple columns, so it's like a grid, open air, but it's more like this. That picture has absolutely nothing to do with the Pool of Bethesda. That's just a picture of a colonnade. What they unearthed looked like this. Again, don't let me convince you that that middle divider was in the middle. I don't know where it was. I just had to draw something, and that's what I drew. So one end's a deep end, and one end is a shallow end, and it's a colonnade that goes all the way around it, and there's a colonnade that goes through the middle of it. And that's how it comes up with five colonnades. There's one on the north, one on the south, one on the east, one on the west, and one in the middle. So you could walk around it, through the middle, with the deep end on one side and the shallow end on the other side. So it's interesting to me that in 1964, they found they found evidence that substantiates exactly what John describes. It's also very close to the gate, the sheep gate, that was specified in the passage. So that's just fascinating to me. You'll just have to indulge me. I wanted to talk about it. This is the picture of the Pool of Bethesda. And I think we're obviously at the deep end. This is the deep end. And when you go up towards this end, I have found other pictures that shows the shallow end. But what you got to remember, and I didn't understand this until just recently, is a lot of these sites, they would know that these sites existed, you know, in ancient times. And because something significant happened there, they would want to set it up as a shrine or some holy place. Bob, I'm going to get to you. And they would build something on top of it, often a church building. And they would make it a place of worship. And so a lot of what we see has been added onto it. And it wasn't until that dig that they unearthed the rest of it. Bob. Yeah, it's a better word in that particular instance. Okay. So Christ sees this man. Why is this man there? He's lame, but why is he there? He thinks that there's some opportunity for him to be healed by this water. Was he the only one there? But how many did Christ heal? Isn't that interesting? He also, isn't it interesting that he picked out the guy who had a cot? He picked out the one who could pick something up and carry it away. Because he healed the man by telling him to pick up your bed and rise, you know, and go. And then what did Jesus do immediately after healing the man? He left. He didn't hang around. He left the man to be discovered by the Jews. And what did they discover him doing? Doing work on the Sabbath day. He's carrying a load. Do you think they would have noticed that this man who's been lame for 30-something years? How long was it? 38? No question about that. Hey, John, what happened? They didn't ask. They immediately accused him of transgressing the Sabbath day by doing work. And they said they didn't care. They didn't. No. They may not have. Because they didn't care. They were more worried about what he was doing and not asking who or how the healing took place. They were only concerned about that outward appearance of doing labor on the Sabbath. Now, when questioned by the Jews, because where did Jesus find the man? Jesus did come back and talk to the man a second time. Where did he find him? He was in the temple. Isn't that interesting? The man left the pool of Bethesda. Where did he go? He went to a place of worship. Jesus found him in the temple, spoke to him, and now the man knows who did the healing. And the man goes back and answers the question to the Jews asking about, how did this happen? So now the Jews know that Jesus did the healing. And they come and question him about how he did the work. In summary, 17 through 47, 30 verses. I'm not expecting y'all to give me every detail. In summary, what was Christ's answer? Yeah. And in saying that, who is Christ saying that He is? He's saying, I'm the Son of God. He gives 30 verses of an answer. But when he declared plainly that he was the Son of God, then the Jews sought to kill him. Kind of a big turning point in the account of what's been going on. In this 30 verses, there's four testimonies given. Christ states that there's four testimonies given on behalf of Christ. Yeah, Tim. We get into all the physical aspects of the, where's Shelby? Muscle atrophy? Is that the right word? 38 years, he's not going to just jump up and walk. It would have been logically impossible for him to have done that. And wanted to be there. That's the idea that I get from it, is he is a changed man in a lot of ways. All right. Good, Daniel. Anything else? I'm not trying to rush over anything. But, okay, so Christ gives in his defense that there are four testimonies for Christ in the verses that he states. In verse 33, he says, John the Baptist declared me. You remember when we studied about John the Baptist? And as a matter of fact, I put up the map of where John the Baptist was doing his preaching, and we saw where Jericho was, and we saw where Jerusalem was in the distance. Remember that they sent men to the wilderness to talk to John and to find out, who are you and what is this teaching about? So John the Baptist gave testimony of who Christ was. God the Father has given testimony of who Christ is. Now, when did that happen? Right. He was back in current time, in baptism. This is my beloved Son. Hear Him. The Holy Spirit has given testimony of who Christ is. Now, the answer is up there, but how did the Holy Spirit give testimony? Yeah, through the Scriptures. And that these Pharisees, they had the Scriptures. They should have been able to know. And we've already studied several men who testified, I've read about you in the Scriptures. We've been looking for you because of the Scriptures. And so he calls to their mind the fact that the Scriptures have given testimony. And then he really sends it home in saying, you know, Moses testified about me. Why would that have been such a painful point for the Pharisees? Moses is their leader. And if Moses even, your own leader told you to be on the lookout for the Messiah, and you don't believe him, well then who will you believe?
Well, that's the wording that he used. Moses is the one who accuses you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't that an interesting way to put it? Yeah, I'm not accusing you. Moses accuses you. Bob, did you have something else?
Well, just going to disagree with you just a little bit on
So you're saying that his works... I'd compromise with you over and say there are five. That's a good point that he does say that. I overlooked that. So God the Father testified for him, but then his very works. Anything else? Yeah. What does it say? So he was pointing to others to give his own testimony. Right. That, did he? Yeah. Right. Yeah, he's defining the accusation. Yeah, exactly right. Al? Anything else? All right. So the second Sabbath controversy was over eating grain. Get to the right place here. That is the luxury of teaching one book, is you can just get to the chapter where you're going to teach from and you just stay right there. So Matthew 12 is where I turn to. There's three different instances of this in the Gospels. Verse 1 says, at the time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck grains, heads of grain, and to eat. Were they allowed to do that? So were they allowed just to go into a man's field and just start helping themselves? That's right. Yeah. The Old Testament made provisions for travelers and for the poor, and they could help themselves to enough to sustain a meal. They weren't, as Kerry said, don't take a tool in there with you and start harvesting the man's crop and hauling it off. Now, that's not what we're talking about. So, at least the Pharisees... didn't think that they were doing something against the Old Testament in that regard. But what they do say in verse 2 is when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing excuse me, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. So, they qualify that it's because they're doing it on the Sabbath. That's where the problem comes in. And so, from the Pharisees' perspective, why did they object to them eating? Were they not allowed to eat on the Sabbath? Yeah. 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 Isn't it pretty nitpicky? But that's what they're doing, is they're saying that act of pulling the grain is the work that they're doing that they shouldn't be participating in. And so It's really straining to come up with something to make an accusation over. But this is kind of the mindset of these people.
It's like calling baptism work.
Yeah. In the case of baptism, that's right. So Christ provides a defense for their accusation. I use Matthew 12, and the defense runs through 3 and 5, and then on he gets into a statement. So the defense that's given is first, verses 3 through 4, is about David. And this is referenced back to 1 Samuel 21, 1 through 6. So somebody tell me in a word or two, what did David do? And why did he do it? And why did he do it? He was hungry. True. You might want to elaborate just a little bit on that.
I think it's a question of necessity.
That's what I'm trying to get to. Is what was the necessity that he would eat? I'm hungry, I'm just going to run up to the temple and get... Would he have done that? So what was the necessity? He was fleeing from Saul. Yeah, Jonathan had just warned him in the previous chapter that Saul was going to pursue him. And so he and David's men are fleeing. They're on the run. It's not like they've got all the necessary provisions for food and so forth. And so he goes to the priest and he says, my men are hungry. We're hungry. And so I want to say it's 5 loaves of the showbread were given to sustain them. So we'll come back to that. What about he talks in verse 5, he talks about, what about the priests on the Sabbath day? Do the priests do work on the Sabbath day? What are their duties? They would slaughter animals. They would put animals on an altar. They would light lamps, and they would do. Were the priests in violation of the Sabbath in doing the work that had to be done in the temple? And which, if you compare pulling grain off a stalk and slaughtering an animal, is it of any comparison? It became silly at this point for them to have made this complaint. Okay.
And even the circumstances in 1 Samuel, we don't have time to look at it, but I don't think David did right in what he did there. Because even the priest said, this is a common bread, and they said, well, I need to give it to him. And so I think Jesus is just simply pointing out the absolute hypocrisy of these people. They wouldn't condemn David for doing something that was clearly wrong. Well, we're not doing anything wrong.
All right, and a minute ago I said, we're going to come back to that. That's what we're going to come back to. No, you're perfect. Because I wanted to get to the priest at work and then come back to, would you condemn David? David wasn't right in what he did. The priest actually objected. Said, I don't have any common bread, is the way the priest put it. So there was an objection to David taking this bread. Would you condemn David? Would you condemn your own priest? And yet you condemn men who pull grain off a stalk? He's showing how silly it was for them to make such an accusation. Right. Yeah. He's really exposing them, is what he's doing. And by revealing the very things that you're talking about now. So, then I love the fact that he says, and who am I that you would accuse me? Who created the Sabbath? I mean, literally, who created the Sabbath? God. And you're going to tell God what He can and cannot do on the Sabbath? It's His Sabbath. That's how silly the whole argument becomes. Matthew 9 through 13, there's a demonstration, evidence, of who He is. When you read out of that, verse 8, the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. Verse 9, now, when He had departed from there, He went into their synagogue. And the first thing He says is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? I don't think that's coincidental. I think He's asking that question in direct correlation to what has just happened. Verse 11, what man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into the pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then He said to the man, stretch out your hand, and he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. So, He comes in and He says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Well, how are they going to say no? Because they would have. If one of their flock, one of their herd was in distress, they would have taken the efforts necessary to rescue that animal. And He's saying, and a man's of less importance? So, again, he just really shows how silly it is for them to make such a weak accusation against Him. And the Jews go out and they plot with the Herodians. I gave the answer away because I put it up there. I was going to ask, who are the Herodians? But they are Jews who side with the Herods. They are a sect of the Jews. And so, the Pharisees wouldn't have sided with the Herods. They would have thought the Herods would do things that were contrary to the law of Moses and allowed and would be very permissive about things that the Pharisees would have said, no, they can't do that. But there was a sect of the Jews who were more permissive. And they sided with the Herods on those social things and those government things. So think about what that's happened. The Pharisees, who are very, very strict to the law, have gone and partnered with a group that they would have never have had anything to do with. And they've done this so that they may continue their efforts to kill Jesus. That is fascinating to me, the structure of the cultural structure of how these folks are interacting. Is that the end of it? No. Multitudes are healed. We're just about out of time. Mark 3, 6 through 8 gives the specific regions where Jesus is doing a great number of healings. Verse 7 says, a great multitude from Galilee followed Him, and from Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea, I think that's the way that's pronounced, Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, and those from Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude, when they heard how many things He was doing, came to Him. On the map here, It has the Galilee area. And think about how far they've come. They've come from Judea, Jerusalem. I had to look up where Idumea is. It's this region below Judea. And then it talks about Tyre and Sidon. Well, Tyre and Sidon's way up here. It's not even on that map. So what John's basically saying is, as far as from north to south, multitudes are coming to the region of Galilee because they've heard about Christ and they want to be healed. Thanks for your time. We're out of time.